Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian.
In this hour, we turn our attention to a country rarely in the news, Uzbekistan. What do we know about the country, particularly its religious freedoms and its imprisoning of religious people and prisoners of conscience? Doug Becker speaks with author of a new report on the subject from the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. And first, former President Trump's administration took presidential documents to Mar-a-Lago instead of submitting them to the U.S. archive. Why does this matter?
Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. In recent months, investigators discovered that a significant number of records from the Trump White House were relocated to his personal residence in Mar-a-Lago in Florida. This removal of official papers from the White House poses a significant threat for the security of classified information, but also, and perhaps more importantly, it serves as a major concern for future historians to write accurate and detailed histories of the presidency. On today's show, we will explore this ongoing challenge of maintaining records of presidential administrations for historical records and for future histories. And this did not originate, of course, with Donald Trump. Our guest is Jeremy Suri, professor in the Department of History in the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs at the University of Texas and is the co-author of a recent piece published in The Hill entitled Problems with Presidential Records Are Not Just About Trump with Kenneth Osgood. So Jeremy Suri, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
First off, what's been going on with respect to the records of the Trump administration?
Well, it appears that there was a systematic effort within the Trump administration to destroy, distort, and to hide records. And this occurred at many levels, with the president himself balling up and crumpling documents, ripping them, putting them in the White House toilets, things of that sort, and then others around him destroying documents. As you mentioned in your opening, many documents were taken from the White House to Mar-a-Lago. We believe we've recovered all of those, but that's highly illegal behavior. And most recently, and what motivated the piece that Ken Osgood and I wrote, is the evidence that there's about 7 hours of phone logs missing from the Oval Office for the crucial hours from when the insurrection begins. At the ellipse in front of the White House, and the insurrectionists beat up police officers and enter the Capitol. We don't know who the president's talking to. We do know he was on the phone with people because we have evidence from the recipients of his calls. But we don't have an accounting of how he was spending his time, which is crucial if we want to understand what he was doing to stop the insurrection or perhaps to encourage it.
That issue, the missing 7+ hours, immediately brings to mind maybe the most famous missing information, which is the, I believe it was 18 minutes of the Nixon tapes that have been erased. Is this similar or is this an escalation of, you know, of that case?
Well, I think it's similar insofar as this material only disappears because someone wants it to disappear. Now, it's possible that the records were not kept initially, but if they weren't, that would also have been intentional. From what we can tell, the president was using burner phones, which is usually what criminals and terrorists use, phones that you use once or twice and then throw away so no one can trace them. It's quite extraordinary. I think the president of the United States would be using burner phones in the Oval Office so they wouldn't show up in the normal phone log of his calls. If he was doing that, he could only have been doing that because he did not want a record to be kept. In the case of Nixon's tapes, these are tapes that recorded Nixon's conversations in the Oval Office and elsewhere. And once the tapes were discovered, probably Nixon, though we don't know for certain, erased 18 minutes of a key part of the president's conversation with his chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, when he was discussing his role in the Watergate break-in and the Watergate cover-up. So it might be that in one case you had President Nixon erasing evidence, and in another case you had Donald Trump preventing the creation of the evidence in the first place. But in both situations, it shows a malicious effort to deny the public what is the legally required information about how the president is using his time and using his government resources.
You said legal requirements. What are the laws that that govern the maintenance of records, the maintenance of communications, et cetera, on the part of the president.
So it's actually pretty simple, and it's not that different from those who are state officials or those like you and I, Doug, who work for public universities. What we use in our places of work is of public record. So our emails, yours and mine, on our university servers are public record. What we have on our laptops in our office are public record. The conversations we have, because we're public officials working in public places. Now, this gets a little unclear when we're talking about the private parts of the White House, the White House residence, just as it sometimes gets a little unclear if you and I take our laptop home and we're doing something from home. But in the case of Donald Trump that we're talking about now and Richard Nixon, in both cases, this was work they were doing in the Oval Office, in their public offices. And the law is that they must preserve all records related to their activities, just as you and I have to preserve all records related to our teaching, advising, research activities in our offices. It's a pretty clear thing. And the National Archives preserves this material and collects it periodically and certainly at the end of the presidency.
It seems to be a tension, though, a normative tension, if not a legal tension, between the assertion of executive privilege and the expectation of the maintenance of these records. I guess one answer would be, you know, when they actually get released. So that wouldn't give you justification to destroy the records, because at some point, obviously, historians, you know, should have that access to it. But how does that tension play out? The idea that what the president does is public versus there's clearly conversations, there's clearly information that shouldn't be released to the public for a whole variety of reasons.
Well, going back to George Washington, we have created traditions and they've expanded over time to do just as you said, to protect what would be seen as the necessary confidentiality that the president needs. The most obvious example would be if discussing troop movements. There's even provision in the law that the Supreme Court has upheld, that if you're a newspaper reporter and you happen to get information on troop movements before the troop movements occur, that's the one case among a few where the government can say, please don't publish this, and actually prevent you from publishing that material. So absolutely, executives of all kinds, presidents, business leaders, public institution leaders, need to be able to maintain confidentiality. They should also get confidential information and advice from their advisors. But there's no reason to ever destroy records. The reason we need to have a record of even confidential material is not just because historians want to read it. Future presidents will be making decisions, and they need to know what was decided beforehand. For example, Bill Clinton made a mistake of appointing an ambassador to British Guiana who had been involved in a covert operation to overthrow the president of British Guiana years earlier. And Bill Clinton didn't know that because the records were not kept properly on that. It's important that we have an accurate record of presidential decisions so that we as a society are informed when we go forward. Now, who sees those records is really where the debate is. There is no evidence that the National Archives has not been a good fiduciary, a good protector of records. They have CIA records I would love to get a hold of from 50 years ago, and they don't let go of them. So we're not arguing, I'm not arguing that everything Donald Trump touched should be available for you and I to read. But it should definitely be preserved. And when there is due legal recourse and judges authorize access to the material, as the Supreme Court has, then that material should be available to lawyers who are working in confidence to investigate, as they are now. And so that's the problem. The Supreme Court has said this material should be available. And the way the president has, with the way the former president has prevented it from becoming available, is by either destroying it, stealing it, or doctoring it.
Now, you mentioned an instance where Bill Clinton didn't have access to this information. We know the kind of the famous cases. We know the Nixon case, probably the most famous of these, and then this Trump case, because it's been in the press. But has this been a persistent problem for administrations? How unique was Donald Trump?
As with most things, Donald Trump was unique in the scale of things. But as Ken Osgood and I point out in our piece, there's been a growing pattern of presidents manipulating the record. And it's a reflection of increasing presidential power, which we've talked about on your show, actually, and I've written a lot about. So another example of this is Ronald Reagan. Iran-Contra involves the illegal White House authorization of arms sales to Iran in exchange for the release of hostages, and then the diversion of the money from those arms sales, arms purchased with taxpayer money, that money diverted to Nicaragua to the Contras against the law. Two breakages of the law there. And the documents about Ronald Reagan's involvement and the involvement of others were literally shredded in the NSC by Oliver North and Fawn Hall. Because those documents were shredded, not only were we unable to appropriately hold certain leaders accountable, but future leaders don't actually know what happened. And this is very relevant when we are dealing with trying to somehow fix our relations with Iran. The Iranians have one fact pattern. We have another fact pattern. We don't actually know what's true. And so this has become a problem over time. As presidents have become more powerful, they've used their power, as powerful people often do, to try to cover their tracks. And the point of our piece, Doug, is that we need to think about ways to prevent that from happening, not solely so we can prosecute bad behavior, but so we as a society can be better informed when we make policy in 2025, 2030, 2035.
With that in mind, you mentioned the National Archive is responsible, are the ones who are tasked with maintaining these records. Who runs the National Archive and who are they answerable to?
The National Archivist of the United States is appointed by the President of the United States and confirmed by the Senate. The current National Archivist is, I believe, resigning this year, and there will be a new one appointed. And it's a large agency filled with civil servants. It's really only the top layer that's appointed. The civil servants there are people devoted to archival preservation. Most of them, or I don't know if most of them, many of them have degrees in library science and archival preservation. Many of the younger members are experts in electronic record preservation, which is something we care very much about, preserving text, preserving emails, things of that sort. And these are professionals. I like to think of them almost like accountants, right? They follow the record trail and they protect it and they do an extraordinary job. And we need to let them do their job.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're talking about the preservation of presidential records with Jeremy Suri of the University of Texas at Austin. So, Jeremy, I think there's a pattern here that certainly has me concerned, at least, that whether it's the question about what is executive privilege or what gets preserved or even, you know, the naming of the archivist, you mentioned the growing power of the presidency. This all rests with the executive. So I guess, is there a check on the ability of the president just to declare, you know, what's secret, what's to be kept, et cetera? And I mean, imagine the checks, you know, the court system, how effective has it been?
So the court system is the main check. You're absolutely right. And it has not been very effective because it takes so much time to get there. We had a unique situation with the Nixon tapes. He tried to withhold those. And the Supreme Court, filled with his own appointees, in a unanimous decision, said he had to actually turn over those documents. But even then, that didn't stop Nixon or whoever he tasked from destroying 18 and a half minutes. So the problem is the courts come in as recourse after the fact. They're not there. And I think even though the director of the National Archivist does report to Congress, I think Congress needs to be more of an enforcer here. There needs to be more evidence and checking that on a day-to-day basis, documents are actually being preserved. And quite frankly, I think this is of a larger piece with things I know you've talked about on your show, the role of the Justice Department. And the Justice Department is an executive agency. We've seen the problems with that, with Trump and Nixon, both of them firing attorney generals who they felt were not actually doing what they wanted to do. Bill Barr talks about this, having been Trump's attorney general. So I wonder if part of the answer here, Doug, is also rethinking the Justice Department in general and making the Justice Department more reportable to Congress than to the president as such.
And of course, that's a reminder that Congress tried to rein that question in with special prosecutors and, you know, investigators, which has fallen into disrepute, certainly since the Clinton administration and Kenneth Starr. But the big broad question, I guess, well, actually, that's a more specific question. It's illegal to shred these documents, correct? Has anybody ever been prosecuted for that? And, you know, what's been the result?
So many people have been prosecuted for mishandling government documents. Absolutely. This happens in the intelligence community all the time. And it's happened elsewhere. It happens in states. I'm sure if we looked into the record in California, we would find evidence of public officials, perhaps even university officials, who mishandled the use of government property. It falls under the same law that prevents a university president from using a public airplane, a state airplane, for his own, you know, to go to his daughter's wedding or something like that, right? I mean, it's the same kind of thing. So people get held accountable for this all the time. Often they lose their job. Sometimes they're fined. Sometimes they go to jail. But we've never had a president who's been held accountable for this. That's the difference here. But I would also say that until recently, we haven't had presidents who so flagrantly destroyed evidence. And again, Nixon is perhaps the first story we know of at that scale. What we have with Donald Trump is a almost daily disregard. People were reporting while he was president that he was tearing up documents, putting things in the toilet. I mean, let's just put this in our own lives, Doug. If you and I are receiving student information, which we get all the time, and we're actively destroying that, someone would come to us from our universities, and if they didn't fire us, they would threaten to do that if we continued this behavior. So the question here, again, the core of our piece, is enforcing the law on the president and making sure the president, because of his power, isn't able to be above the law. It's a core constitutional issue. He has to follow the law like everyone else.
And perhaps this is an irony, it feels like one to me, that one of the causes of the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was precisely this issue, that, you know, the Hillary Clinton email question as Secretary of State. So I guess asking, has there been any consequences? Well, I mean, certainly there's been political consequences. Is that ultimately where this rests, that there needs to be a political cost to be borne? If it turns out that the criminal justice system may not be as effective as we'd like it to be?
Well, there should be a political cost. And you're absolutely right. It's dripping with irony, isn't it? Hillary Clinton did mishandle her emails. You know this, Doug. Everyone who works in Washington in a federal office where they're getting classified emails has two phones. She refused to use two phones. She was mixing personal and business and was appropriately criticized for that. Now, whether that should have ruled her out as a presidential candidate or not is a debatable proposition. The irony is the person who criticized her for that, or those who criticized, did far worse, far, far, far worse. There's no evidence Hillary Clinton destroyed any evidence, that she misused it but didn't destroy it. So I think there should be political cost to this, but I do think that really there should be vigorous criminal justice prosecution of these issues, because this is the vital public record. And the irony on ironies here is that right now we are enforcing this at the low levels, but not at the highest levels where it matters most. I mean, the documents Trump is destroying, or the documents the Reagan people destroyed, the documents Nixon destroyed, are documents of enormous significance for the future of our policymaking. We need to do everything to protect them and preserve them, again, not just for historians, but also for future policymakers.
You did say not just for historians, but I'd actually like to turn to that question, because you focus Sure. quite a bit on policy questions. But as a historian, particularly the modern presidency, how much does this practice challenge, you know, you and future historians trying to write these histories?
It poses a huge challenge. And I have confronted this myself writing about Iran-Contra. There are millions and millions of pages of documents on Iran-Contra, but there are very few documents that lead up to the president. Now, some of that was by design. Presidents are often very careful not to put their names on a lot of things, but we do know there were meetings where Reagan was informed, where the topic came up, and it's very hard to follow that. And this is a very important issue when evaluating Ronald Reagan. And I fear we're going to have more and more problems like this. Again, we have so much evidence, almost more evidence than we can ever deal with, but often we're missing the most important evidence. And for us to have an accurate historical record, we need to do everything we can to preserve that.
Now, of course, the issue we started with was phone logs. You mentioned burner phones. You also mentioned younger archivists dealing with electronic issues. It seems like the days of written memorandums, you know, written memos, letters that were sent, are long gone. How much of a challenge is just our move to electronic sources and the ability to delete a lot of those sources, some of which are kind of intended to be deleted?
Well, it is a challenge, but it's also an opportunity, because actually more of what we do now is documented, at least in an ephemeral way, than ever before. It's rare that we talk to each other, right? I mean, we text, we email, we are writing all the time. And so in a sense, we're in a better position than we were when you had someone on the, this is often how things worked for Henry Kissinger, someone's on the other line listening to him, his secretary trying to scribble down what he's saying on the telephone. Now, much of our discussion is by text, it's by email. So it is preservable. And younger archivists, talented, trained archivists are finding ways to preserve this electronic material. They also generally print a lot of it out so that we have a printed record. I think the real question is making sure that the platforms people use, they're going to change over time, but they have to preserve things. If you're in government, everything you're doing should be on a preservable platform, not on a platform where things disappear immediately. And that's not a hard rule to enforce, it seems to me. So that's where we have to go. But the challenge is, just as you say, that people will use ephemeral platforms that intentionally erase things. That is actually a crime under the law. So when Jared Kushner and others were using WhatsApp to communicate, they're actually not allowed to do that. You and I are not allowed to do that in terms of student records. We're not allowed to hold a faculty meeting that way. So we can use new technology, and we can make it an opportunity if we regulate the use of it for the purpose of posterity.
You've mentioned that. I just want to take a moment and say we were all required to verify communications as supervisors, you know, here at the University of Southern California, a common practice across universities. So are we being held to a higher standard than, you know, than the president?
Yes.
And when you say being held to a higher standard, I guess the last sort of core area I want to address is, it seems like, especially this question about the phone log and, you know, the broad questions here, like so many issues in contemporary American politics, is tied up in partisanship. That at the end of the day, whether or not those 7+ hours of phone logs are even significantly raised as a legal, as a normative issue, is going to rest essentially with the January 6th commission, which is as much as, I mean, there is a bipartisan presence, it's definitely been a partisan lightning rod. So I don't want to come to the conclusion that commitment to maintaining records is a partisan question. So I guess quell my fears that is this one party is committed and the other party is not, or how can we overcome some of the partisan divides to build this as a norm that we all just recognize as,
yep,
you know, it's essential,
yep,
to have this information?
It's a fantastic question, and it might be the most important question, right? So right now we're in a situation where the Democrats want the records from Trump because they'll embarrass Trump, and the Republicans would definitely want these records from Obama if we turned it around, right? Or from Biden now. So it's you want the records from the other side, but you don't want to keep the records from your own side. And that's a problem. That is why this appropriately belongs in the legal system. That's why this needs to be handled and prosecuted in the legal system. And even if you can't put the person in jail who's done this, if you harass them enough, it provides a deterrent. At the very least, I'm hoping, and this is why I'm talking about this, Doug, so much, I'm hoping that we raise the issue, you and I and others, and so it discourages leaders in the future from doing this, right? Most leaders, most elected officials, most public officials don't want to have trouble. They want to follow the law. And so what would be most scary to me is if we didn't talk about this, we let it just go by, and then it became a norm on both sides just to destroy records. So we need to support the legal system. By the way, it is in the statutes, it's in federal statutes, that if you mishandle documents as a federal official, you are disqualified from office. I imagine someone will try to pursue that if President Trump were to try to run for office again. I'm not sure it would lead to anything, but we should prosecute the law. We should fulfill the law.
I think on that point, the importance that the law gets fulfilled, the importance that this norm is upheld for policy, you know, for future policymakers, for historians, and I think perhaps most importantly to me, at least as a small D Democrat, for political discourse, to ensure that that the discourse reflects the history and reflects the policies.
Yeah, I mean, if we believe in democracy, when we had this insurrection on January 6th, we need to know what the president was doing. And not just because you hate or like Trump. The president has a sworn responsibility, and we as citizens need to learn how we can make sure, if this happens again in the future, that presidents are fulfilling their responsibilities. That is a small d, as you say, responsibility that I'm certain the founders would agree with us on that.
Absolutely would agree as well. Our guest has been Jeremy Suri. We've been discussing the role of the importance of the preservation of records from presidential administrations, the role of the National Archives, and the legal responsibilities to maintain these records for historians, for future posterity, and for discourse within a democracy. Jeremy Suri is a professor in the Department of History and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas in Austin. He holds the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and is the co-author of a recent piece in The Hill entitled Problems with Presidential Records Are Not Just About Trump with Kenneth Osgood. And let me also say he's got an upcoming publication called Civil War by Other Means. I'm certain we'll have you on the show when that book comes out and discusses this as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
When we come back,
Uzbekistan is an Islamic country. But does it respect the rights of its Muslims? If so, why then does the country imprison its people considered prisoners of conscience and religious prisoners? Stay with us. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. We turn our attention to a country rarely in the news, Uzbekistan. What do we know about the country, particularly its religious freedoms and its imprisoning of religious people and prisoners of conscience?
Doug Becker explores.
I'm Doug Becker. One of the fundamental freedoms recognized by human rights instruments worldwide is the free exercise of religion. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights declares in Article 18 that, quote, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience, and religion. This right includes freedom to change his religion or belief and freedom either alone or in community with others and in public or private to manifest his religion or belief in teaching, practice, worship, and observance. The U.S., in support of this principle, has created the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom. On October 12th, 2021, the commission filed a report on Uzbekistan's religious and political prisoners. On today's show, we interview the author of this report. Steve Swerdlow is Associate Professor of the Practice of Human Rights at the University of Southern California. Prior to this position, he practiced human rights litigation, worked for the United Nations Development Program, and perhaps most importantly for this report, was a senior Central Asia researcher at Human Rights Watch. Steve, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
I guess to start, can you synopsize the findings of the report?
Well, this report came at a particular moment. I was following, as you mentioned, when I worked for Human Rights Watch, I was responsible for monitoring human rights violations in one of the world's most repressive countries, Uzbekistan. And one of the ways that Uzbekistan distinguished itself in its bad human rights record for many years was, and this wasn't widely known to many people in the West, was that the former president, Islam Karimov, who was in power for 27 years, viewed even though his country was a Muslim majority and is a Muslim majority country, he viewed religious believers who practiced their belief free of the state, outside strict controls, as a potential threat to his rule, as an existential threat to his rule. So very early on in the 1990s, Karimov decided to put in place very rigid controls. That meant that the sermons that you would hear delivered at mosques would be praising the government. You were not allowed to pray privately in your home. You had to conduct yourself and observe your religion in accordance with a very Soviet era version of Islam, a state approved version of Islam. And if you remember back to this time in Uzbekistan, the Soviet Union was collapsing. Uzbekistan was dealing with enormous problems, corruption, and all of the Muslims of the Soviet Union were now finally able to start studying and practicing Islam in a way they hadn't been able to for 70 years. So that naturally led to a lot of exploration, a lot of the population of young Uzbeks and men, especially in the more religious areas of Uzbekistan in the east, the Fergana Valley, a densely populated region, to start seeking out new forms of practicing religion. And that also meant that groups from other parts of the world, like an organization called Hizbut Tahrir, which is not a terrorist organization according to Western countries or the UK or the United States, but is viewed with suspicion in Uzbekistan, started bringing on new followers. And when the government saw this, when Karimov saw this, he started to get worried. And by the late 90s, Uzbekistan introduced a law that was incredibly, one of the world's most restrictive laws on religion. Like I said, private religion, the practice of religion basically banned. Men that wore their beards, facial hair long, as is customary in a lot of Islamic practice, were viewed as terrorists and extremists. Women that wore the hijab virtually disappeared from the streets of Tashkent in Uzbekistan. And it became a very, very repressive environment, to put it mildly. After 1999, though, it got much worse. There were limited small-scale terrorist attacks in Tashkent, which we don't, even to this day, we don't know exactly who was responsible. But the government used this as a pretext to begin arresting thousands and thousands of peaceful religious believers across the country. And this is what led, sorry for this long introduction, to so many thousands of religious prisoners being in Uzbekistan's jails. So at around 2004, there may have been upwards of 7,000 religious prisoners. And I call them religious prisoners because, as you said in the introduction, if you are imprisoned for the practice of a fundamental right guaranteed by international treaty, that's a political prisoner. And I think religious prisoners are a subcategory. So fast forward to this report. In 2016, the dictator, Islam Karimov, finally passes away. That ushers in a period of some reform. And the government begins to understand that in order to improve their reputation, they should start releasing political prisoners and relaxing the environment for the practice of religion. So they began to release some of these prisoners. And of course, I was very interested in this, and the US Commission was very interested in tracking how many people were released, how many people are still in prison, and how many people can we classify as peaceful? That means there's no connection to violence, no evidence of attempted violence. And I should say again at the very beginning that this report, my research and USERF recognize that every country deals with security threats. And certainly Uzbekistan is in a neighborhood that is not very safe. We have Afghanistan to the south, lots of instability around. But still, the right is fundamental to practice one's religion. So that was the context for why we launched this research, and also because the political environment with this new president, or now he's been in power for 5 years, that Shavkat Mirziyoyev, allowed for me to return to the country after being banned for 7 years by the Karimov government. I returned, and it seemed like a moment where we could again do this research.
Uzbekistan particularly comes to mind in the global war on terror. You mentioned that they are on Afghanistan's northern border. And immediately when I think of questions about political prisoners and human rights questions, what immediately comes to mind were the allegations, and I believe these have been proven, that Uzbekistan was a pretty popular location for suspected Taliban or, you know, Al-Qaeda members that weren't necessarily brought to the U.S., the so-called rendition policy, right? And has, you know, these so-called black sites that the government was supportive of, you know, of torture, detainment, you know, those sorts of questions. How much does that connect with this policy?
It's very relevant to what you mentioned, Doug, and some of your listeners might know indeed that rendition became widely known, and the cooperation during the war on terror was brought to light by a quite colorful character, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, whose name was Craig Murray. Around 2004, 2005, he outed MI6's cooperation with the Uzbekistan security services in the interrogation and sometimes torture of suspected Taliban and Al-Qaeda. And why is that relevant to this research? Well, because the same practices of persecuting religious prisoners with torture, which is something that comes up again and again in all of the cases that we document in this report, are the same tactics that were used shamefully in that period and do implicate the West and make the West somewhat complicit. And therefore, we have to be vigilant and we have to study this history. And that was another reason to try to document quite as detailed as we could the types of torture that have been routinely used on religious believers, and also the types of charges that have been exploited and used by the government, charges of extremism, charges of terrorism, which are vague and overbroad and are not specific.
Okay, so now we've got this historic background and the challenge, but you had described in the last 5 years a potential opening where, you know, some of these practices could be at least softened, if not reversed. In the report, how successful has Uzbekistan been at becoming more compliant with human rights instruments?
And this brings us to the core findings, which is that, of course, we found that there have been some positive changes. I should start with the positive, of course, which is that thousands of religious prisoners were released. Uzbekistan has always been notoriously closed and secretive in its government data on the prison system. I was very lucky in the course of my research at Human Rights Watch. I was one of the few people that after the International Committee for the Red Cross was kicked out of the country and no longer able to visit prisons, I was able to visit two prisons in 2018. And I can say that the research shows that the prison population overall in Uzbekistan was in 2014 about 44,000 individuals. Now it's about 23,000 individuals. That was one of the findings of this report. There was an overall reduction of the prison population and a release of thousands of people that should not have been in prison. Again, these are peaceful religious believers. But the key finding is that the government continues to imprison approximately, according to our calculations, about 10% of the prison population, about 2,200 individuals. So that still puts Uzbekistan on the map in the world as one of the leading persecutors of religious believers. It's a very serious finding. But again, that number, as I mentioned earlier, it used to be around 7,000, maybe even up to 10,000. So huge population of people that require our immediate attention. And I should make a parallel here, a quick comparison to Nelson Mandela. When we think of the most egregious examples of political imprisonment in history, we think of Nelson Mandela, who was in prison for almost 25 years. That's what I'm talking about in terms of these cases. Most of these people were imprisoned in 1999, 2000, 2001, 2002, 2003, and through a variety of very creative methods used by the government, had their sentences extended and resentenced in prison in these secret trials that didn't conform to international standards. So that was another finding of the report, was this practice of resentencing people over and over and over again, and of forcing them to ask for forgiveness in order to receive a pardon in a way that also violates international standards. So despite all the reforms, despite the releases and somewhat of a relaxation of the environment, continue to see this really large population of people in prison that should not be there.
But considering Uzbekistan's role in the global war on terror, there's human rights concerns, but it's not necessarily a violation of Article 18 if governments are imprisoning people in groups that pose a significant security threat to the state. So, I mean, if you're imprisoning jihadist groups, there certainly can be concerns, but that's a different concern. Is that what's going on in Uzbekistan, these ties to, you know, Al-Qaeda networks or other jihadi groups?
See, that's a very interesting thing about here. And much of the data and the thinking by the government about extremist groups has often been hard to verify because Uzbekistan is so closed. Because, for example, after the Andijan massacre of 2005, when the government shot and killed peaceful protesters, the country virtually closed down to foreign organizations. There have been no PhD researchers or scholars able to go in and actually verify what you are asking right now, which is what are the numbers of actual extremists, what is the level of penetration of extremist groups in the Uzbek population? And by and large, my research has showed, and I think most of the scholars I respect deeply, is that there is not credible evidence of a significant penetration of jihadist groups. What you do have is a very Soviet Soviet-inspired approach to looking at, as we were discussing, to religion. The organization Hizb ut-Tahrir, which you probably heard of, based in London, it certainly espouses views that probably you or I wouldn't find sympathetic. I'd certainly be the first to say that it's an anti-Semitic worldview that that group espouses. But one thing that's notable, the reason that the group is not considered a terrorist and extremist organization by the United States or the UK or the West largely, is because they don't call for violence. And so when the government paints things with a broad brush in Uzbekistan and says that these groups, which are ideologically unappealing, are extremists, they create a false equivalency. And I think they actually create the risk of radicalizing more of the population by imposing on them artificial constraints, by not allowing them to interact, as I was saying, to freely discuss religion in contexts that are not rigidly controlled by the state. There's actually a campaign of forced beard shaving of men that was a characteristic of the cream of time and then stopped for a while and has started up again. But you're right, Doug, to say that these are definitely sensitive issues and the security concerns are real. The facts, though, are that there have not been very many terrorist attacks in Central Asia at large. There was an attack, if you remember, a few years ago in neighboring Tajikistan, which took the life of five or six bicycle tourists. That was the first successful Western ISIS attack that killed foreigners. And there have been a handful in 25 years of, as I mentioned, the 1999 attack in Tashkent, 2004 and 2009, but I'm talking less than 10, certainly less than 100 victims in over 30 years. So what's interesting about Central Asia is it can't be easily conflated with the issues we see in Syria or Iraq, but the government obviously fears those things. And I recognize those are legitimate concerns. There's also the issue of ISIS recruitment, which if you think back to 2015, 2016, these were big issues where large numbers of Central Asians were going to ISIS-controlled territories in Syria and Iraq. But the interesting thing is that the Uzbek government has, in contrast to Western European nations, actually been repatriating women and children from formerly ISIS-controlled territories and rehabilitating them. So what I've tried to say in the report is that we praise that approach. That's actually much more conducive and consistent with international law, as opposed to keeping people in prison who have no evidence of violence for 20 years or 25 years.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're discussing a recent report on Uzbekistan's religious prisoners with its author, Steve Swerdlow, of the University of Southern California. So, Steve, this report was submitted to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedoms. I suspect a number of the listeners aren't exactly sure, where this commission comes from. So sort of under whose auspices was this commission created and what ultimately is its mission?
Its mission is to monitor religious freedom conditions around the world. It comes into being during the Bush administration, but it's a genuinely bipartisan congressional advisory body. So the commissioners, so to say, that chair it, that lead delegations and research visits around the world and make most of the public statements are appointed by the president. And also, I believe the Speaker of the House can make appointments. And it's made up of both Republican and Democratic appointees, and they rotate. And what's interesting about this is, while it may have been perceived when the commission was first created as a body perhaps more focused on defending the rights of Christians, my report is a pretty strong testament to the dedication of these bipartisan commissioners to raise issues on behalf of Muslims and to look at all countries. And what they do that's most relevant to policy and to your listeners is that every year the commission makes recommendations to the State Department and the White House about which countries are so-called countries of particular concern, CPC countries. And what happens when you get on that list? Well, you don't want to be on that list. Uzbekistan was on that list for about a decade. And the CPC countries are countries that can be sanctioned for particularly egregious violations of religious freedom. So you have countries like Saudi Arabia, Nigeria. Uzbekistan was long on the list. Tajikistan on the list, countries that really distinguish themselves by, as you said, violating Article 18 and not living up to their obligations. And so it's a whole wide array of religious persecution that they're looking at, Buddhist extremist groups, persecution of Christians, and of course, what we're talking about here in Central Asia. So I found it as a human rights activist particularly useful to work with the commission because the CPC designation carries with it some serious consequences and countries don't want to be on that list. And once they're on it, they want to get off. And that's been one way that we've been able to convince the government to actually release these prisoners. And that's in, you know, part of the story also that's interesting is since the report was published in October, there were 81 out of these 2,200 prisoners. 81 of them I was able to get photos and detailed biographies. And so we feature 81 stories of these individuals. And already a number of them, about five or six, have been released, maybe more, which certainly is not enough. But it's evidence that in my experience, when you start naming names and giving specific data, that's when governments can't ignore the reality. And that's the biggest justification, I think, for what the commission is doing with this report.
As a follow-up, though, I know critics of U.S. human rights policy have accused the U.S. of using human rights a little bit disingenuously, that it tends to reflect their geostrategic interests. They are much less likely to criticize countries that they view as, you know, allies geostrategically. I think of, for example, you mentioned Saudi Arabia, you know, religious freedom in countries like Saudi Arabia or Egypt don't get criticized anywhere near as much as, say, you know, accusations of lack of religious freedom in countries like Iran. So I guess, how confident are you that these types of reports don't just become a tool on kind of a larger geostrategic interest as opposed to really truly being committed to human rights advancement?
Well, good question. I mean, yeah, of course, there's never going to be any advocacy in human rights that can be completely divorced from the geopolitical context. And I think when I wrote this report, what I was most interested in was there were two aspects. One, of course, was getting people released that shouldn't be in prison. And I believe strongly that some of these individuals, one of them that was recently released, in fact, his name is Avaz Tokhtakhajaev. He was arrested in 1999. He had his sentence extended five different times. Can you imagine this? You're coming close to being released. You've served your sentence for 5 years. And one day a prison official comes in and says, you know what? I think you put your prison slippers in the wrong part of the cell, and that's a violation. And you're going to get an additional 3 to 5 years for doing that. Or in fact, you made a mess in the kitchen, and that's going to cost you. That's what we would see. And so when I was writing this, I really wanted to create a record of information that would empower these families of those imprisoned to keep seeking justice. And in fact, you know, we are seeing some results. So that was one of the ways that I thought, okay, despite everything, that's the purpose that this should that we're seeking here. The second, though, was to put the history, as we were discussing in the beginning, into a form that could maybe be accessible for posterity to Uzbeks to read about their own history, because there's no one teaching the repression and the repressive period of the 1990s Uzbekistan, which is a formative period, to Uzbek society. And in fact, last week, the commission put some significant money behind actually translating and publishing the report in Uzbek, which was a big deal that to have the report actually both in Russian, available in Russian and in Uzbek. So I think I do agree with you that the U.S. certainly is not immune. But when I'm meeting with the families, the victims, the human rights activists that helped me write this report, I think they see it more from the perspective of the practical value that it can have as a human rights document. But I do agree with you that at times when certainly U.S. moral leadership on human rights, when questioned, makes our job much, much harder to convince governments that they need to live up to obligations. Certainly the establishment of a commission on inalienable rights during the Trump administration, which tried to rewrite human rights in a different language was a very damaging moment that we're still trying to come back from.
I imagine as well during, you know, particularly the U.S. military operations occupation in Afghanistan was a particular challenge in Central Asia. And kind of,
well, that kind of cuts both ways, not to cut you off there, but in some ways that the U.S. military the U.S. military operations did provide a layer of security, a buffer in a way between the Taliban and the instability in Afghanistan and the Uzbeks. So in a way, there were some, certainly from a human rights perspective, very problematic aspects, and it changed the nature of the relationship, made it a military and transactional one. But in other ways, I always try to see the glass half full. It also provided also certain forms of leverage to raise human rights issues. And now it's hard to say where we are after the withdrawal. In a way, the withdrawal of the U.S. from the region in some ways creates a vacuum for other actors like China and Russia, who are not rights respecting nations, to fill that void, which is also not very good for human rights.
I know you specialized throughout Central Asia, and part of what you're describing, you know, in the period of the 90s, the early 2000s, reminds me of what I always thought was a wonderfully provocative title of Dilip Hero's account, Between Marx and Muhammad, you know, in this period. And so it's in that spirit. How typical or atypical is Uzbekistan's policy vis-a-vis religious communities, the practice of Islam within the region, in particular, because, I mean, we know there's areas, whether it's the Uyghur population, you know, in China, other areas across Central Asia, where the practice of Islam has certainly been targeted for abuses.
It's very true that Karimov's repressive approach, the law on religion that I referenced earlier, which was at that time one of the most restrictive laws, was then copycatted. Putin, in recent years, has introduced laws on religion that really mirror what Uzbekistan was doing in the 90s. So in fact, we saw a conviction of a Jehovah's Witness who was labeled as an extremist and given 6.5 years in prison several years ago. We also see the same approach, very repressive, in neighboring Tajikistan, Turkmenistan. Now, Kyrgyzstan has always been more open and struggled a bit more between these two poles of cracking down on religion, controlling religion, and allowing more religious expression. Kazakhstan also has had very similar legislation. Also, Azerbaijan is known for a large number of religious prisoners, not as many as Uzbekistan. So we, you know, from Russia all the way to, and you now mentioned the Uyghurs, and I'm not a China expert, but I do think that this approach of criminalizing peaceful religious activity and viewing it through the lens exclusively of extremism, of writing laws that are so vague and so overbroad that you can use them as pretext, I think that is the theme here. And so my hope is that as from a legal perspective, we need more clarity in criminal codes. Of course, no one is going to tell, not China or Uzbekistan or Russia, that they don't have a right to fight terrorism. They do, but they have to do it consonant with international human rights law, which means that they have to respect the freedom of religion, but they also have to allow due process. And of course, with the Uyghurs, you know, this mass detention and torture, I don't want to say necessarily that China learned that from Uzbekistan, and China has its own legacy, but these practices build upon one another, and they're shared and exchanged in organizations like the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which became more and more important over the last 20 years. And so I think Eurasia in particular, and of course we're not even mentioning Ukraine, is in a sort of a very long-standing human rights crisis and deserves a lot more attention.
And the last question then is, how has this report been received? Both, I mean, has there been any reaction, any response coming out of Uzbekistan, and then also the reception here in the United States?
Yeah, that's interesting, because the Uzbek government, I should say, they were very cooperative with the commission at the start of the research. They met with me, at least 8 or 9 government agencies sat down with me. They gave me the figures of about 22,000, 23,000 prisoners that I mentioned. I was certainly not interfered with in the way I did my research. The government did not, however, agree to provide written answers to our questionnaires, in which we asked for the numbers of people convicted on charges of extremism. Interestingly, though, notably, there's been a somewhat muted but at times critical response. At the same time, the Uzbek ambassador in Washington, D.C. agreed to be on a panel discussion. And he said, though, that he didn't agree with this number of 2,200. But notably in all these situations, what I notice is there is not a specific rebuttal to the data that we provided. So we say approximately 2,200. We know that there's some room for error there, but notably the government has not been able to rebut that finding, nor have they provided the actual information. So I think it's an ongoing process. I know that discussing these issues, just discussing them, the fact that the ambassador would meet and discuss it in a public forum was important, an important step. And I'm going to hope to continue the research when I return to Uzbekistan. I hope to visit more prisons. I hope to meet with more prisoners and work with their families and lawyers. And I think the biggest opportunity coming up in the future will be if we can reform, as I was saying, reform the criminal code and empower local civil society. We need more human rights organizations to do this work on an ongoing basis. I come in, you know, once every few months, but I think it's more important that we can cultivate a human rights community that's able to monitor these cases on a consistent basis.
I think what is probably most impressive is the way that community emerges, you know, within Uzbekistan itself. And the methodology of this was very much to draw the connections with the communities themselves, you know, within the country and allow them to tell their story. And in that spirit, we've been discussing this new report that was filed at the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, entitled Uzbekistan's Religious and Political Prisoners Addressing a Legacy of Repression, an ongoing campaign to highlight the importance of religious freedom. And in particular, what I find fascinating with this is the religious freedom of Muslims, because certainly as a global community, Muslims have been targeted, their belief has been targeted quite significantly over years and years, but definitely in the recent past. Our guest today has been the author of the report, Steve Swerdlow. He is an associate professor of the practice of human rights at the University of Southern California, and prior to that, worked as a human rights litigator for the UN Development Program and also as a senior Central Asia researcher at Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Sed Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.